I'd like to welcome everybody to this next class that we're going to have in our Puritan paperback series. This will be a little different this year than previous years. The subject matter that we're going to attack is certainly doctrinal, but it has quite a bit of application to it, and so this year's class will be relatively speaking, far more interactive than previous attempts. So what we're going to try to cover this summer, and I hope to do this in about 8 weeks, is this book called The Mystery of Providence. It was written by a man named John Flavel. And we're going to divide the class up into really three different sections. The first will be today's lesson, which is an introduction to the life of John Flavel. Give you an idea of who he was and some of the circumstances of his life. And then we will continue with studying two chapters in the Confession on the decrees of God and the chapter on Providence to lay the groundwork for this great topic. And then we will proceed to cover the book as a whole. Now, some of this book is, we'll look at the kind of the outline of the class at the very end, but we're not going to take 1 week per chapter as we have in the past. We'll take a little bit different pace, and the we will have the kids in that are presently in or at present in Dr. Fisher's class will be in here as well, and the class will be also geared a little more toward helping them through these topics. So let's take a look at the life of John Flavel. He was a remarkable individual, and in broad categorizations, his sermons were considered sizzling hot. He was a very popular preacher in his day and had a remarkable life. It was a life filled with a great deal of suffering and burden and trouble, and I hope to take a look at a few of those things. So if you have any questions about this life as we're going through, just raise your hand. We probably won't pause for questions until the end. So at the first part, let's take a look at the early years of Flavel. John was the eldest of two boys, the other being named Phineas. Both were eminent ministers of the gospel, following in the line of their father Richard. The Flavel home was one that was marked by piety and devotion, and John was religiously educated by his father, and having profiled well at the grammar schools, was sent early to Oxford and settled a commoner in University College, where he took up his studies. We don't know exactly what year he went to Oxford. That record is not available to us, and perhaps it is in his diaries, but they're not published at this time. So we're not exactly sure what time he arrived, but he does appear to be rather young when he finished. So Flavel completed his Bachelor of Arts around the age of 20, and after graduation he received an offer to come and preach as a probationer in Deptford, County Devon. Deptford is a very small town. It's located in the southwest of England. It's not far from Dartmouth, Exeter, not terribly far from Plymouth. But it's in that region. It's not a port city per se, but near enough to Dartmouth, which is. He was there to assist the Reverend Walplate, and he was settled there by the Standing Committee of Devon on April 27th of 1650. So around 20 years old, he received his first line of work after college, being assistant to a minister in a very small town at the time. So after about 6 months after his settling in Deptford, he heard of an ordination to be at Salisbury, and therefore went thither with his testimonials and offered himself to be examined and ordained by the presbyters there. They appointed him a text upon which he preached to their general satisfaction, and having afterwards examined him as to his learning, they set him apart for the work of the ministry with prayer and imposition of hands on the 17th day of October of 1650. So he's around 20 years old when he's not only got this job, he's now ordained and having been successfully examined by his elders there. After ordination, Flavel returned to Deptford and continued his work with Walplate. One of the reasons that he was requested to go to Walplate to help this man is because he was in failing health, and they wanted some sort of succession of ministers and continuation there to keep the preaching up. But Walplate's health didn't last all that long, and so Flavel took over his health and succeeded him in the rectory after, I think, about 6 months or so. It wasn't long before Walplate died. Flavel had a very difficult life. And these early years, though marked with a tremendous amount of success, finishing his BA early at Oxford and being successfully ordained into the ministry, you could say in one sense that these were the high points of his life. And from there, the marks of suffering came rather swiftly. He married his first wife, Jane Randall, a pious gentlewoman of a good family. They were not long together, for she died in travail of her first child without being delivered. So Flavel, within probably a year to 2 years, graduating from college, being ordained, then getting married, and wife being with child, soon finds himself a widower and without his baby. After a year or so of mourning, he was urged to marry again, which he gladly did. I actually could not find the name of this wife anywhere, so I'm not sure how she's referred to, but she was with him, besides Mrs. Flavel, that's right. That's right. Now, during these early years, Flavel also participated in a provincial synod, and he was required to do so, as most ministers are. In fact, he was the moderator of this synod for some time, and through his work, he cultivated a friendship with the minister of Dartmouth. And this was a man named Hartford, who was had the work there. Apparently, when Hartford had died, which was not too many years into Flavel's ministry, the people of Dartmouth had issued a call to Flavel upon hearing of the good report that Hartford had made for him. So sometime after the second marriage, the people of Dartmouth in the county of Devon unanimously chose Mr. Flavel for their minister. And that comment about being unanimously chosen, I think, was important because some of the other ministers apparently that they had interviewed received mixed reviews. Flavel's arrangement in Deptford was good for him. He was well provided for and had a good working relationship with the people. For reasons unknown, the work in Deptford was a better provision than that of Dartmouth, which was certainly a much larger town. For it appears that relocating to Dartmouth resulted in his great loss of temporals, the rectory of Deptford being a much greater benefice. He was installed December 10th, 1656, so he's about 6 years into his ministry. And I'm still a little puzzled as to why the church in Deptford would have been better financially and for his temples, as they mentioned, rather than Dartmouth, which was a much larger city and a port town as well. Flavel developed quite a preaching ministry during these early years. His sermons were popular and very effective. One of his judicious hearers expressed himself thus concerning him: "I could say much, though not enough, of the excellency of his preaching, of his seasonable, suitable, and spiritual matter, of his plain expositions of Scripture, his talking method, his genuine and natural deductions, his convincing arguments, his clear and powerful demonstrations, his heart-searching applications, and his comfortable supports to those who were afflicted in conscience. In short, that person must have a very soft head, or a very hard heart, or both, that could sit under his ministry unaffected." So his ministry was certainly enjoyed by all, as we'll see some other quotes here a little bit later. But Flavel had a habit, a personal writing habit, a study habit, of recording for his, I think you pronounce it his adversaria, his collection of notes and sayings and proverbs and illustrations and anecdotes. He amassed quite a collection of these things over the years, and they provided a quite a stock for his sermon material and for his works that he decided to have published. And apparently what he would do is if somebody had said something that struck him as particularly noteworthy, he'd ask him to repeat it. He'd get his pencil and paper and record the thing, and then he'd keep it in this collection of notes that he had done, which was actually not altogether uncommon for people to do. They didn't have as many Bartletts book of quotations and such as we find today, but they would collect them for themselves. That manuscript has not been preserved, though.
These arguments are against him, I take it, with the adversary?
No, that's the name of that type of book, Adversaria, I don't think has anything to do with being an adversary.
Okay,
yeah, it's just the name of a collection of books.
Okay.
Yeah. The manuscript I was looking at actually misprinted the word, or misspelled it, and it took me a while to figure out exactly what word they were referring to at the time. Well, if you'll recall from how many years ago in our church history study, specifically covering the 1660s,
a long time ago,
these were very difficult years in the life of England during the 1650s, as we've seen, and coming into the 1660s, the nation's embroiled in civil war. There is unrest in Parliament. These were rough times to be alive in England. Of course, the Westminster Assembly had met and concluded their business by this time. So the nation was undergoing a thorough amount of transformation, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse. And the ministry, I think it could be said, was one of the more affected areas of the political and religious transformation of the time. They had a very difficult time of it in some parts. In 1662, Charles II issued a decree requiring all ministers to adopt the rites and ceremonies of the Book of Common Prayer. This act had tremendous implications for the church. Many ministers, a good many ministers, would not comply with the requirements of the act and were ejected from the ministries and oftentimes were replaced with more compliant men. So you had a situation with the great ejection taking place for these fellows who had a pastorate, were now found without a pulpit, without any means of support for themselves or their families, and either the church was left vacant or the state had found someone who was a bit more compliant in their willingness to adopt the Book of Common Prayer to assume the pastorate there. The act of uniformity had the effect of pushing the godly out of the established churches and into the countryside. To combat this conduct, another act was issued. Well, let me back up for a minute. That one of the things that had happened, as we say, these guys got pushed into the countryside, both in England and Scotland, since it was now illegal for the minister to hold the pastorate if he would not align himself with the Book of Common Prayer. They started meeting in the fields. They started going out into the woods.
Question for you.
Yes.
You said this guy is a presbyter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he wasn't part of the Church of England. I don't know much about John Flavel, so he was in a Presbyterian system instead of Anglican. Because Anglican, that's episcopacy, that's not
right.
Presbyterianism.
Right. And the some of those lines, in my mind, were rather cloudy during those years because when many of the ministers found themselves ejected, they formed what were called nonconformist ministers union or ministerial unions. Yeah, and so some of these fellows found themselves working within one group of people and then finding themselves out of work working with another group of people. And so he was listed as a Presbyterian minister, but I think it was also a state church. And so I think some of the lines there at Dartmouth were a little cloudy. And I haven't been able to determine. It was specifically referred to as some of the provincial synods that he had attended. And yet I'm not exactly sure how that complied with the Act of Uniformity and what was happening. So they didn't spend much time detailing or chronicling those episodes. So in 1664, another act was passed by Parliament called the Conventicle Act. And this act forbade the religious assemblies comprised of more than five people outside the auspices of the Church of England. So in order to keep people from meeting together in the countryside, because they realized that all they had done is push people out of churches and into the woods, that they formed another law to make sure that no more than five people assembled themselves together to discuss religious things if they were doing so outside the auspices of the Church of England. Now, the number of ministers ejected from their pulpits is just staggering. I think it was in the order of 2,000 or better. Does that sound right to you, Jeff? Yeah. So the land, the great ejection was a had a tremendous effect upon the land in terms of the way churches were being managed. Many of them, many of these ministers, continued to work with the people in their own flock as best they could under these difficult circumstances. And obviously they were successful because these private meetings had taken people to the what were so common that Parliament found it necessary to develop the Conventicle Act in order to combat meeting of all these folks in these private woodsy-like church services. Now, the thing to remember is that these services were all illegal, and the consequences for participating in them were grave. People who were caught in these conventicles. You recall the print we got the pastor, was it last year we did that? Yeah, I think it was. Picture that the men were assembled to church, and they each had a fair number of them anyway had had their guns with them as they had attended. Well, there was a reason why they were well-armed when they went to church. Soldiers were looking for them, and they found it necessary to defend themselves. Now, John's parents, Richard and his wife, were directly affected by these acts at being a minister who was ejected himself. And a little before the turning out of the nonconformist ministers, Richard preached from Hosea 7:6, "The days of visitation are come, the days of recompense are come, Israel shall know it." His application was so close that it offended some people and occasioned his being carried before some justices of peace, but they could not reach him so that he was discharged. He afterwards quitted that country and his son's house, which was his retiring place, and came to London, where he continued in a faithful and acceptable discharge of his office till the time of the dreadful plague in 1665, and that he was taken and then imprisoned under the following circumstances. He was at a Mr. Blake's house in Covent Garden, where some people had met privately for worship. Whilst he was at prayer, a party of soldiers break in upon them with their swords drawn and demanded their preacher, threatening some and flattering others to discover him, but in vain. Some of the company threw a colored cloak over him, and in this disguise he was, together with his hearers, carried to Whitehall. The women were dismissed, but the men were detained and forced to lie all that night upon the bare floor, and because they could not pay £5 each, were sent to Newgate, where the pestilence raged most violently as in other places of the city. Here Mr. Flavel, the father, and his wife were shut up, and seized with the sickness, they were eventually bailed out, but died of the contagion. So here you could directly attribute the death of Flavel's parents to the act of uniformity and complying them or compelling them to go to prison because they were meeting privately in a house for worship. The plague, of course, was ravaging London around this time, and Flavel, again, is marked. John is marked with another round of suffering, seeing his parents lost during this, after also having been ejected from his own congregation. Well, things get worse. We have a new act by Parliament in 1665. The results of the Act of Uniformity and the Conventicle Act were not sufficient to please the authorities, and so in 1665 another law called the 5 Mile Act, or sometimes referred to as the Oxford Act, was enacted. The 5 Mile Act was one of the English penal laws that sought to enforce conformity to the established Church of England. It forbade clergymen from living within 5 miles of a parish from which they had been banned unless they swore an oath never to resist the king or to attempt to alter the government of church or state. Now, that's quite an effective ruling. You can see that from 1662 to 1665, the government is attempting to suppress in every way it can religious assemblies, and all they've been able to do is push them out into the countryside. And to combat this, they decided to have make it illegal for the ministers to live within 5 miles of their banned parishes. Now, if you've got to walk or ride a horse wherever you need to go, I don't know how long it takes to ride a horse 5 miles, but I suspect it's going to take a little bit of time. And the situation was such that this kept the ministers from going into the nearby woods in order to conduct their worship services. Flavel was in Dartmouth at this time. His parents had gone to London. They had stayed with him for a number of months during the ejection. But due to this act, he was forced to leave Dartmouth to the great sorrow of his people, who followed him out of town, and at Townstall Churchyard they took such a mournful farewell of one another as the place might very well have been called Bochum, which is the place of weeping in Judges 2:1-5. He removed to Slapton, a parish 5 miles from Dartmouth, or any other corporation, which put him out of the legal reach of his adversaries. So now he's on the run again, and he's attempting to go to a place where legally he's outside the bounds of the soldiers and the authorities, but it will be short-lived. Flavel continued his preaching ministry at Slapton. In fact, he preached twice every Lord's Day to such as thirsted venture to hear him, which many of his own people and others did, which I think is a remarkable fact considering the difficulty of not only the travel involved to make it to the other town, but considering you could be arrested and fined for having done so. During these troublesome days, Flavel would travel back and forth to Dartmouth and to the surrounding cities to check on his flock and to preach regularly. The authorities by this time were actively looking for him and trying to locate him while he was in the midst of preaching, so he was definitely cautious in whatever ways he could be. In one encounter, Flavel was in Exeter, which is not far from where Dipthorne and Dartmouth is. Exeter, I think, is to the northeast just a bit. Nearby, preaching in a wooded area 3 miles outside of town when the authorities came. Flavel was in the midst of his sermon. He was already preaching when they arrived, but he managed to escape. Many of those who were in attendance were taken and fined. Flavel proceeded to another location and resumed his preaching to all who could attend. Now, that struck me as an odd characteristic contrasted to today's church, to imagine the police, the thugs, busting up church service, and everybody scatters and goes to another place in the woods so they can finish hearing a sermon. I thought it was remarkable, the willingness of the people to not only hear God's word, but endure imprisonment and fines to do so. Well, the next act that is passed that affects the ministry is the Royal Declaration of Indulgences in 1672. Charles attempted a peaceful resolution, although I think the records indicate Parliament was suspicious with his motives, and offered a suspension of those laws which sought to keep Protestant ministers from their pulpits. Flavel took this opportunity to preach frequently and to continue his ministry back in Dartmouth. So the 5 Mile Act was successful for a time, but for some reason, I'm sure for Charles' own gain, he decided to pass this Indulgence Act, which allowed ministers at least some temporary reprieve in returning to their pulpits. And I'm not quite sure the history on Parliament's resistance to this, other than their suspicion he was trying to establish a state church again through different means. It was probably not a bad idea to be generally suspicious of whatever Charles II was doing, so I'm not sure they needed a whole lot of justification to wonder what was up there. But as I mentioned earlier, Flavel's life was marked with suffering. He had lost his first wife and his child, and he had lost his parents at the hands of godless rulers who had put him in Newgate, knowing that the plague was spreading rapidly. And now God would take his second wife. So he is, in a span of about 22, 23 years, he's lost his parents, he's lost his church, he's lost his ministry, he's lost at least one child through the death of his first wife. And he was remarkable in his commitment to preaching God's word regularly during these times. In a convenient time, however, he married a third wife, Anne Downes, daughter of Mrs. Thomas Downes, a minister of Exeter, and who lived very happily with him 11 years and left him 2 sons. So this third wife of his spent many years with him while he was also during the next stage of the marks of suffering. Flavel decided to go to London for a time. He decided that it would be better and wiser for him to spend some time there. And so he decided from Dartmouth, which is a port city, And I emphasize this idea of a port city for a number of reasons, some of which we'll get to at the end concerning the way he wrote and the topics. But he decided to take a ship to London, and we're not exactly sure why, but he had a dream the night before he was to leave, or maybe a couple nights before he was to leave, and I won't give you all the details of the dream, but he was left with the impression afterwards that terrible things were going to happen while he was on this ship, but that God would keep them safe. That he was not going to be harmed, but he would certainly be frightened on this. So he mentions this to his friends and asks their counsel, or they offer their counsel, and they tell him everything will be fine. The ship's going from Dartmouth to London. You're not going to have any trouble. He's not so convinced of that, but he decides to go anyway. So accordingly, when they were advanced within 5 leagues, which I think is about 15 miles, is that right?
Somewhere in there.
Okay. Of Portland, in their voyage, they were overtaken by a dreadful tempest, insomuch that betwixt 1 and 2 in the morning, the master and seaman concluded that unless God changed the wind, there was no hope of life. It was impossible for them to weather Portland, so they must of necessity be wrecked upon the rocks or on the shore. Upon this, Mr. Flavel called all the hands that could be spared into the cabin to prayer. But the violence of the tempest was such that they could not prevent themselves from being thrown from one side unto the other as the ship was tossed. And not only so, but mighty seas broke in upon them as if they would have been drowned in the very cabin. I think it's a remarkable occurrence that this ship is being tossed about, and the master, the seamen have all concluded they're going to die. They can't find any safe port at this point. And Flavel has the presence of mind to gather people together into his cabin to pray. You know, a lot of people pray under difficult and trying circumstances, but few pray while they're being tossed about in a room and nearly being drowned by the waves coming over the side. So this is, again, a real mark of his piety. Mr. Flavel, in this danger, took hold of the 2 pillars of the cabin bed and, calling upon God, begged mercy for himself and the rest of the ship. Amongst other arguments in prayer, he made use of this, that if he and his company perished in that storm, the name of God would be blasphemed, the enemies of religion would say, that though he escaped their hands on the shore, yet divine vengeance had overtaken him on the sea. Quoting the Paul, again, I find a remarkable composure of mind. In the midst of prayer, his faith and hope were raised, insomuch that he expected a gracious answer. So that, committing himself and his company to the mercy of God, he concluded that duty. No sooner was prayer ended, but one came down from the deck, crying, "Deliverance, deliverance, God is a God hearing prayer. In a moment the wind is coming fair west," and so sailing before it, they were brought safely to London. So here we have a circumstance in which he nearly died as a result of this tempestuous storm, and yet God delivered him again. You know, Paul makes a point of noting these sufferings in his life in Corinthians and what he had endured over the years for the sake of the gospel. And we find the same thing through many of these ministers of the 17th century, that it was a difficult time for them. London was good to Flavel, for he was able to continue his ministry there. We're not exactly sure why he left Dartmouth this last time, but he did, and his ministry is prospering. So the suspicion is, at least to some effect, that he was there for ministerial reasons and he couldn't continue in Dartmouth. During this stay in London, he married his 4th wife, a widow gentlewoman. So this is the 4th time. I couldn't tell you the exact time. He'd been married for about 11 years to that previous woman. And through the indulgence of... So this is probably the mid-1680s. So the guy's somewhere been in the ministry about 30 years. No. Yeah, something like that. Commencing in 1650. He's married his 4th wife. Buried the rest. I mean, it's hard to imagine the magnitude of the suffering that one person may endure. But to have buried 3 wives and be on the run from the authorities is quite a task of anyone. It was a difficult life. Flavel, while he was in London, narrowly escaped being taken with the Reverend Mr. Jenkins, this would be William Jenkins, another Puritan minister, at Mr. Fox's in Moorfields. This isn't the John Fox of Acts and Monuments. He lived about 100 years earlier or so. While they were keeping a day of fasting and prayer, so here the ministers have gathered together, as well as a few others, and were observing a day of fasting and prayer, and you might ask why. Well, the nation's still in a great deal of turmoil in the 1680s. I suspect James II is probably on the throne by this time, somewhere around then. Do you remember when he ascended? Yeah, so this could be about the time. Either Charles is about to go or James is about to enter. So he was so near to being taken prisoner that day that he heard the insolence of the officers and soldiers to Mr. Jenkins when they had taken him, and observed in his diary that Mr. Jenkins might have escaped as well as himself had it not been for a piece of vanity in a lady whose long train hindered his going downstairs, Mr. Jenkins, out of his too great civility, having let her pass before him. Let that be a lesson to you, ladies. Jenkins was a very effective minister. He has probably is most well known for his for his commentary on Jude, which is a massive undertaking of a commentary. I think the outline to his commentary on Jude, if I'm not mistaken, is something like 17 pages long. Now, the book of Jude can't be more than about 20 verses, but his outline is a good 17, so it is a good read. It's well done. But I'd like to try to complete this picture on how rough the times were during these days by recounting what happened to Jenkins during this time of imprisonment and his friend Flavel and another one that was there. Jenkins was committed to Newgate, and if you recall, this is the place where Flavel's parents were imprisoned and succumbed to the plague. The petition, Jenkins was an influential minister, and there were those around him who sought to petition the king for his release, and so he had a number of attempts to convince Charles, and I recall now it was Charles who was ruling at the time. The petition was accompanied by certificates from his physicians that his life was in imminent danger from his close imprisonment. Yet all the answer which could be obtained from this ungrateful monarch was, Jenkins shall be a prisoner as long as he lives. You might ask, what was his crime? Well, depends on who you ask. If you ask Charles, the crime was really treason. He was attempting to subvert the state. If you ask us today, what was his crime? Conducting a religious worship with five or more people in a room outside the auspices of the Church of England. Now, the restrictions to which he was subjected in Newgate were exceedingly severe. He was very harshly treated, and he was not a young man. The keepers were prohibited from allowing him to pray with any visitors. Now, it's one thing to try to keep a guy quiet in prison. Imagine trying to keep him from praying, even with his own daughter when she would visit. Nor was he permitted to leave the prison to baptize his grandchild, though a considerable sum as security for his return were offered for that liberty, which was not an uncommon thing to impart. They weren't trying to bribe anybody then. Soon after his confinement, his health began to decline. His soul was filled, though, with unspeakable joy and comfort. This was not the first imprisonment of Jenkins. After 4 months of confinement and suffering, he died in Newgate, January 19, 1685, in the 72nd year of his age and the 52nd of his ministry. The news of his death soon reached the court. A nobleman in waiting had this to say to the king, "May it please you, Majesty, Jenkins has got his liberty." Upon which he asked with surprise, "Aye, who gave it to him?" The nobleman replied, "A greater than your majesty, the king of kings," and with which the king seemed struck and remained silent. Flavel, by this time, has returned to Dartmouth, but it was no easy choice. He was called by Jenkins' own congregation in London to take the pastorate there upon Jenkins' imprisonment and death, but he refused that call so he could be with his people back in Dartmouth. It's interesting that the offer in London was for a greater sum of money, a greater benefice, and more prestige, certainly, than what Jenkins could, or what Flavel could have obtained in Dartmouth, but he decided that he wanted to stay in his small town. By this time, some of Flavel's materials had been published, and certainly London would have given him greater access to the publishing efforts than what Dartmouth did. But because of the act of uniformity still being in effect, the congregation could not support him. You know, what they had to give was under the table, if you will. They couldn't actively support him. And therefore, his wages must have been, I would assume, relatively poor for him to do this. So he gave up being in London, which had many rich people, influence and prestige, and could have continued his ministry very successfully there, and he had been doing, but he decided to go back to his own flock, which he had pastored for so many years in Dartmouth. He was, in a little time, after confined close prisoner to his house, where many of his dear flock stole in overnight or betimes on the Lord's Day in the morning to enjoy the benefit of his labors and to spend the Sabbath in hearing, praying, singing of psalms, and holy discourses. So he had the additional discomfort of returning to Dartmouth and, in effect, becoming under house arrest, that he wasn't allowed to travel freely. In 1685, which again, this incident will really show the rancor of the locals, some of the people of Dartmouth, accompanied too by some of their magistrates, rent-a-thugs, made up his effigy, carried it through the streets in derision, and with the covenant and bill of exclusion pinned to it, set it upon a bonfire and burnt it. So this man was a very effective minister, and the state obviously was well threatened by his preaching ministry, and to the effect that they were burning effigies of him in the streets of his Dartmouth. You know, to imagine the commitment of this man to his own flock to give up arguably a much better life in London, to find himself back in Dartmouth under house arrest with people burning effigies from his work there. In 1687, when it pleased God to overrule affairs, that King James II thought it was in his interest to dispense with the penal laws against them, Mr. Flavel, who had been formerly confined to a corner, now began to shine brightly as a flaming beacon upon the top of the hill. His affectionate people prepared a large place for him when God blessed his labors to the conviction of many people by his sermons on Revelation 3:20. Now, that's an important mark because Flavel really enjoyed, at least toward the end, a good success in his printed ministry, which he had not, I don't think, enjoyed as much earlier. So he took these sermons and printed them, and I think it's "Behold, I Stand at the Door and Knock" is Revelation 3:20. But they printed them under the title "England's Duty Under the Present Gospel Liberty." So if you'll consider the circumstances, he had been under house arrest. James is now lawfully on the throne, and restrictions are now relaxed somewhat. And he publishes a series of sermons called "England's Duty Under the Present Gospel Liberty." Very timely application. Hoping that it might do some good abroad as well as in his own congregation, he made a vow to the Lord under his confinement that if he should be once more entrusted with public liberty, he would improve it to the advantage of the gospel. This he performed in the most conscientious manner, preaching twice every Lord's Day and lectured every Wednesday, in which he went over most of the third chapter of St. John's Gospel, showing the indispensable necessity of regeneration. Flavel's sermons were in print, and they were also broadly distributed. He would receive notes and letters from those who had been affected by his work, and in one account of this influence, a bookseller that was trading in Flavel's sermons related this story to him. There came into his shop, or into my shop, a sparkish gentleman to inquire for some playbooks. Mr. Boulder, the shop owner, told him he had none, but showed him Mr. Flavel's little treatise of Keeping the Heart, entreated him to read it, and assured him that it would do him more good than playbooks. The gentleman read the title, and glancing upon several pages here and there, broke out into these and other such expressions. What a damnable fanatic was he who made this book. Mr. Boulder begged of him to buy and read it, and told him he had no cause to censure it so bitterly. At last he bought it, but he told him he would not read it. What will you do with it then? Said Mr. Boulder. I will tear it and burn it, said he, and send it to the devil. Mr. Boulder told him that he should not have it. Upon this, the gentleman promised to read it, and Mr. Bolton told him if he disliked it upon reading, he would return him his money. About a month after, the gentleman came back into the shop again in a very modest habit and with a very serious countenance, bespoke Mr. Boulder thus, "Sir, I most heartily thank you for putting this book into my hands. I bless God that moved you to do it. It has saved my soul. Blessed be God that I ever came into your shop." And then he bought 100 more of those books of him and told him he would give them to the poor who could not buy them, and so left him praising and admiring the goodness of God. Thus it pleased God to bless the sermons, discourses, and writings of Mr. Flavel. You never really know what the effect is upon people and ministers. And in this book, there's the Mystery of Providence, there's a recounting of a story of a man who recalled a sermon, and if I'm not mistaken, something like 80 or 85 years after Flavel had preached it, and it was the means of converting him. So we'll read that story in the class. So our concluding thoughts on Flavel. He was a man of middle stature and full of life and activity. He was very thoughtful, and when not discoursing or reading, much taken up in meditation, which made him digest his notions well. He was ready to learn from everybody, and as free to communicate what he knew. He was bountiful to his own relations and very charitable to the poor, but especially to the household of faith and the necessitous members of his own church, to whom, during their sickness, he always sent suitable supplies. He freely taught academical learning to 4 young men whom he bred to the ministry, and one of them he maintained all the while at his own charge. The manner of his death was sudden and surprising. His friends thought him as well that day, in the evening in which he had died, as he had been for many years. Toward the end of supper, he complained of a deadness in one of his hands, that he could not lift it to his head. They put him to bed with all speed and sent for physicians, but to no purpose. His distemper prevailed upon him so fast that in a short time it made him speechless. He was very sensible of his approaching death, and when they carried him upstairs, expressed his opinion that it would be the last time, but added, "I know that it will be well with me," which were some of his last words. Thus died the holy man of God suddenly and without pain, not giving so much as one groan. He exchanged this life for better on the 26th day of June, 1691, in the 64th year of his age. So up until that time, he had actually been at a meeting of other ministers, and I think he might even have been moderator of that meeting, which was earlier in the week, so he died rather suddenly. And some have assumed this meant he died of some sort of stroke. Well, there's before you John Flavel. Soon before you, you'll have a book, The Mystery of Providence. That's the subtitle. The proper title is called Divine Conduct. Flavel has a 6-volume set of books that are published by Banner of Truth. They are still in print. And I copied a few of the titles to give you an idea of some of the material that Flavel prepared. A Display of Christ in His Essential and Mediatorial Glory, A Treatise on the Soul of Man, England's Duty Under the Present Gospel Liberty, A Narrative of Some Late and Wonderful Sea Deliverances, and keep in mind, he was at a port city, Navigation Spiritualized, A New Compass for Seamen, A Caution to Seamen, A Dissuasive Against Several Horrid and Detestable Sins, The Seaman's Companion, 6 Sermons on the Mysteries of Providence as relation to seamen and their sins, dangers, duties, and troubles of seamen. A Token for Mourners, an Exposition of the Assembly's Shorter Catechism, and this book here, which is actually a exposition upon Psalm 57:2. Flavel was a remarkable man, and his... I didn't include, but in his works are a number of references to diligent husbandry, taking care of the land, taking care of the things that God has given you. Very, very practical in his application. He's not like reading Owen. He's a very readable author at various levels. So I think you'll enjoy the book. But I guess I'd like to issue the apology for why I bothered to study this particular book. Providence is, I guess you could say in part, this is a continuum of the series we've begun a couple years ago. We studied The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. What does it take for man to be content? We studied Jonathan Edwards, Charity and Its Fruits. How can we love one another as the Bible directs us to? And it was in part my opinion that to tie these things together, in order to effectively discharge those other duties, one needs a very strong perspective on providence. How does God rule over all things? How does he order things? How much does he order? Where does man's will reside in these decisions that are made every day? Is God the author of sin? These are questions that I'd like to address this summer to help us on the foundation of obedient Christian living by understanding how God does what he does. Now, as I mentioned, not every chapter in here will deserve a full review. Some of the chapters are quite short. We'll combine a few things. And next week and the week after, we'll be looking at two chapters of the Confession of Faith, chapters 3 and then chapter 5, on God's eternal decree and on providence. And then we'll take a look at the book proper. And in closing, I'd like to read the first few verses, first three verses of Psalm 57 to give you an idea of what was motivating Flavel. Psalm 57, "Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you. And in the shadow of your wings I will make my refuge until these calamities have passed by. I will cry out to God Most High, to God who performs all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me. He reproaches the one who would swallow me up. Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth." In particular, we'll be looking at that portion of verse 2, "to God who performs all things for me." That's the question we're trying to answer this summer. How does God do that?